Chapter 18. A Choice Between Interests and Values. Laurent. The attacks on Khadija's phone had been relentless, according to further forensic examination by the security lab. The first Pegasus infection on her mobile phone appeared to have been on March 28, 2019. The spyware operators were back in the phone just 5 days later, and again in May, June, July, and August. They attacked Khadija's iPhone on 4 separate occasions in the first few weeks of September alone. On September 10, 2019, 3 days after an attack on Khadija's iPhone, NSO Group trumpeted its new corporate governance regime. This updated policy was designed to bring the company into alignment with the UN Guiding Principles of Human Rights, read the press release, cementing the company's existing industry-leading ethical business practices. NSO announced the formation of a Governance, Risk, and Compliance Committee, as well as a separate set of outside experts who could offer the company guidance on human rights issues. One former secretary and one former assistant secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, as well as a French diplomat who had been first secretary at the embassy in Tel Aviv and an ambassador to the U.S. NSO also announced the hiring of a new general counsel, Shmuel Sunray. Sunray went in with eyes wide open, he would tell reporters. We understand the power of the tool, and we understand the impact of misuse of the tool, he said, not long after he started at NSO. We're trying to do the right thing, to find the right balance. The newly announced policy and personnel were merely a codification of protocols already in place, according to NSO. There would still be a rigid vetting of all potential end users of NSO's weapons-grade cyber surveillance system. Key to the process was a case-by-case risk analysis to determine the likelihood of misuse by any country seeking a license to deploy Pegasus. NSO's attorneys and its compliance committee always took into account the country's record on human rights, rule of law, freedom of the press and expression, and corruption. NSO said it was aware of the very strong relations between issues of corruption and the issues of human rights. The compliance team had a very good place to start their vetting procedure, which was the annual rankings assigned by at least 7 different international indexes, including the World Bank's Control of Corruption report and Freedom House's Freedom in the World report. Azerbaijan was an interesting case in point, index-wise. The Aliyev government scored somewhere around the bottom 15% of countries in the World Bank's Control of Corruption rankings in 2019, when Pegasus had first been loosed on Khadija. And that was its highest grade on that comprehensive report card. The country had slid precipitously in the Freedom in the World rankings by then and consistently hovered at the edge of the 10 worst of the worst countries. Azerbaijan scored a bit better than North Korea, Syria, South Sudan, Eritrea, and Equatorial Guinea. It was on par with Libya, Somalia, China, and Saudi Arabia. Of the 179 countries in the Reporters Without Borders annual index, only a dozen scored below Azerbaijan in protecting freedom of the press. Those were just numbers. The evidence supporting these rankings was far more compelling and damning and relentless. The lead of the Human Rights Watch annual reports on Azerbaijan had been pretty consistent for nearly a decade. The government's unrelenting crackdown decimated independent, non-governmental organizations and media. Courts sentenced at least 25 journalists and political and youth activists to long prison terms in politically motivated unfair trials. Appalling human rights record did not improve in 2018. Authorities continued to maintain rigid control, severely curtailing freedoms of association, expression, and assembly. Continues to wage a vicious crackdown on critics and dissenting voices. The space for independent activism, critical journalism, and opposition political activity has been virtually extinguished. Human Rights Watch also reported specifics of their findings about Azerbaijan. Ilham Aliyev's strongest political opponents tended to get about 3% of the vote in both presidential and parliamentary elections, so that even the European monitors bribed by the Aliyev government couldn't bring themselves to call the voting free and fair. The election process itself was organized at a high level, was the best one German observer could offer. Yet somehow, that 3% still rankled, So Aliyev's security services remained vigilant in their effort to drive political opposition to the vanishing point. "These people were in a bad psychological state and have been for many years," the Azeri president said of his critics. "People who have such a negative attitude of their own nation, their own people and state, can only be called traitors to the nation and anti-national forces." Opposition figures kept ending up in psychiatric hospitals, often for treatment of their paranoia. Other alleged traitors to the nation, or more specifically to President Aliyev and his family, were arrested and beaten. One said he had been whacked for an hour with a truncheon, so bad I could no longer feel pain. An attorney who called attention to this extra-legal torture had his law license revoked. Invented charges of hooliganism or drug possession landed many of Aliyev's political opponents in prison for extended stays. A conviction of insulting the honor and dignity of the president was good for up to 5 years, thanks to tough new laws enacted by the Aliyev-controlled parliament. Two men who refused to admit to defacing a statue of the president's father were beaten by police, threatened with rape, and sentenced to a decade in prison. The 2020 Azeri military offensive in a long-running conflict with Armenia, according to reports from international observers, teemed with war crimes on both sides. The Azeris attacked residential areas with cluster munitions, which had been banned because of their widespread indiscriminate effect and long-lasting danger to civilians. Armenian POWs were deprived of food, water, sleep, and medical care. The prisoners reported being burned with cigarette lighters, subjected to electric shocks, and punctured with metal rods. Journalists didn't fare much better than POWs. The public reporting suggested a love-hate relationship between President Aliyev and the press in Azerbaijan. The president loved the Azeri media he controlled, which was almost all of it by 2019. He had once gifted 255 apartments to reporters and then showed up to accept his third Friend of Journalists Award from Baku's local press council. He hated the writers and editors who were critical of him and his family and their unexplained wealth. Those journalists did not get free apartments. They got harassed, threatened, and intimidated even after fleeing the country. A female reporter living in the United States got the Khadija blackmail treatment in 2019. Someone from Azerbaijan sent her intimate photographs of her and her boyfriend and told her to cease her broadcasts about the president's finances. "You have 7 days to show you have quit," read the message to her, "or we will expose you." Afghan Mukhtarli, the husband of Leyla Mustafayeva, Khadija's friend, who had helped me get my tapes out of Azerbaijan back in 2014, was kidnapped in the country of Georgia in May 2017. Their investigations into the Aliyev family corruption made it too dangerous to stay in Baku. The kidnappers blindfolded Afghan, broke his nose and his ribs, put 10,000 euros in his pockets, then handed him off to Azeri law enforcement, who threw him into a jail in Baku. He was convicted of smuggling contraband, the 10,000 euros, and served almost 3 years in prison. President Ilham Aliyev's extremely thin-skinned dictatorial comportment and his well-deserved low ratings on the scale of human rights, rule of law, freedom of the press and expression, and corruption was an awfully large and ungainly lump for NSO Group and others to sweep under the international carpets, and had been for years. President Aliyev, one U.S. diplomat admitted, complicates our approach to Baku and has the unfortunate effect of framing what should be a strategically valuable relationship as a choice between U.S. interests and U.S. values. By 2019, Ilham Aliyev had a pretty good idea of where the democracies of the world would land on this difficult and torturous choice between their interest and their professed values. He'd been given plenty of glimpses behind the curtain over the previous 20-plus years, starting when he was invited to headline a Strengthening Democratic Institutions Project seminar at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University in 1997. Turned out the notions of democracy and human rights and freedom of expression didn't really come up much. Rule of law got some play, at least where financial instruments and business contracts were concerned. Ilham Aliyev was wearing two hats at that seminar. He was the only son of the sitting Azeri president, and he was first vice president of the state oil company of the Azerbaijan Republic, SOCAR. Both the MC of the event and the first speaker after Ilham were current Kennedy School professors and past and future officials in the U.S. Department of Defense. The other speakers were executives at six oil companies already doing business in newly independent Azerbaijan. The recent U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, made a brief talk about the West's desire for strong military partnership with Aliyev's father and the geopolitical necessity of security and stability in Azerbaijan. I want you all to do a thought experiment and imagine there were no oil in Azerbaijan, Carter said. If there were no oil in Azerbaijan, it would still be an important place. It would be a geopolitically important place to the United States. We would still have an interest there, and we should still have a security strategy there. The next six speakers at the Kennedy School event put the lie to that proposition. Oil and natural gas were the entire point of the seminar because oil and gas were the crucial point of engagement between Azerbaijan and the West. Europe and the U.S. were a bit skittish about the shrinking supply of the commodities so crucial to their citizens' creature comforts and their country's industrial output. Expectations at the time were that oil production in Europe was going to shrink by almost 2 million barrels per day over the next decade, while demand there would be increasing by that amount. The U.S. was also girding for a drop in its domestic oil production and a rise of prices at the pump. Meanwhile, three countries sitting on about 250 billion barrels of proven oil reserves, Iran, Iraq, and Libya, had proven unreliable trading partners. Azerbaijan was among the key untapped sources of oil and gas in the old Soviet republics, so major oil companies from Europe and the U.S. stood ready to do their part in the tapping and to reap the profits. SOCAR VP Ilham Aliyev had already overseen production sharing agreements between his company and many of the biggest oil-producing companies in the world. The contract of the century had flooded Azerbaijan with the cash and know-how needed to get that black gold out of the Caspian seabed and off to needy European markets and beyond. The plan was to build three separate pipelines to move Azerbaijan's valuable export. The first crude oil produced by the partnership had been sucked out of the Caspian and into a newly constructed shore terminal just 9 days before the Harvard seminar, and this promised to be but a drop in the new and growing bucket. The most optimistic estimates of the oil reserves under the Caspian Sea ran to more than 200 billion barrels, enough to fuel all of Europe for almost 40 years. Saudi Arabia-type numbers, a development executive from Pennzoil noted. Even if most of those reserves properly belonged to Iran, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Russia, Azerbaijan's proven 7 billion was a still very alluring little honeypot all on its own. For Exxon and for the rest of the industry, we have two jobs to do in Azerbaijan, one of the seminar speakers explained. First is to find and size the resource, the remaining reserves, and then hopefully develop multiple routes to multiple marketplaces. A slogan that has become popular with the industry and with SOCAR now is, happiness is multiple pipelines. We support that concept. The six oil company executives at Harvard heaped copious praise on the progress Azerbaijan had made in just 6 years of independence from the Soviet Union. The Western oilmen in Baku could find restaurants serving excellent Chinese food and Mexican and Cajun. They could buy Italian suits, French wine, and other luxury goods. The Azeris were working hard to learn the language of international commerce, English. The speakers at the Kennedy School Forum, to a man, also heaped praise on Ilham's father for far-sighted policies that not only attracted foreign investment, but placed it under legal and judicial protection. Azerbaijan's prosperous secular government serves as a model for other governments in the new independent republics. Azerbaijan is a very reliable partner for industrial development, not only in our business, but I think in all business. The progress is unprecedented, certainly in my business experience, and probably in the history of our industry. Just over 20 years later, and 16 years into Ilham Aliyev's own oil industry-friendly presidency, the lessons he had first learned still applied. His very low rankings in human rights, rule of law, press freedom and expression, and his very high rankings in personal corruption were generally beside the point. As long as Azerbaijan helped feed the gaping maw of the European oil and gas market and spread the profits among a handful of powerful European and American corporations, nobody was going to deny him much of what he wanted. or call him out too loudly on his most heinous behavior. I had witnessed this firsthand back in early 2014 on my reporting trip to Baku with President Hollande and French energy company executives who arrived with their hands out. That politicians, human rights activists, and journalists in Azerbaijan were being surveilled, blackmailed, tortured, and imprisoned was not a subject of discussion on that trip. When I sought out the victims of Aliyev's vicious campaign against his detractors, I became a target for harassment and theft. The Azeri security services confiscated our computer drives and was later dragged into a French court and unsuccessfully sued for libel. President Aliyev objected to us calling Azerbaijan a dictatorship. I tried to raise the question of human rights in Azerbaijan at a joint appearance of President Hollande and President Aliyev at the Elysee Palace later that same year. This was a breach of protocol at the palace, where reporters are not supposed to shout questions during photo ops. But sometimes, protocol be damned. There were more than 90 Azeri citizens being held in prison for criticizing or challenging Aliyev. Leyla Yunus, one of the most outspoken human rights activists, whom Hollande and I had both met in Baku, had been jailed 6 months earlier on questionable fraud and tax evasion charges. She was also being denied much-needed medical care. "Mr. Hollande," I yelled from behind a cordon about 30 feet away, as the two men walked toward Aliyev's waiting limousine. "Have you considered asking your counterpart to release political prisoners in his country?" "We have discussed it," Hollande answered. "And what is his response?" President Aliyev barely even glanced at me. He kept his eyes on Hollande. "But he was going to look into the matter in detail," Hollande answered. "About the case of Leyla Yunus, who you met in Baku?" I asked, which did draw Aliyev's attention for just a flash. He didn't speak much French, but he clearly recognized the name. "That's been done," Hollande insisted, meaning, I guess, he had raised the issue. The two leaders smiled at one another, shook hands, and parted. Hollande back inside his residence, and Aliyev across the graveled driveway toward the open door of his waiting limo. I kept trying now with Aliyev in English. "Are you planning to release political prisoners in your country?" He just kept walking toward the car, as if I wasn't even speaking. "What are you planning to do about Leyla Yunus?" Ilham Aliyev clearly felt no need to answer such a question, and certainly no obligation. He drove off without acknowledging my presence. Hollande refused my later request for a formal interview to discuss human rights violations in Azerbaijan. The status quo held. Ethics officials in the U.S. waved off the fact that Sokar had spent $750,000 to wine and dine American congressmen at the recent U.S.-Azerbaijan Vision for the Future conference. Members of the congressional delegation had been gifted silk scarves, crystal tea sets, rugs, and free travel. Lobbyists in the U.S. and Europe happily accepted millions of dollars to quash a damning report on political prisoners in Azerbaijan. Aliyev's operatives reportedly spent 30 million euro to persuade members of the Council of Europe, whose sole mission was to bolster democracy on the continent, to ignore the long and continuing Azeri record of human rights violations. In October 2017, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development approved a 450 million euro loan to help fund Sokar's and partners' gas pipeline from Azerbaijan to Western Europe. The following March, the European Investment Bank signed off on a 930 million euro loan for the pipeline. "The EIB did not condition the loan on the improvement of human rights," wrote Human Rights Watch, "even though its obligations under the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights meant it should not finance projects that would encourage or support human rights violations." Exactly a year later, and not long after the new pipeline went into operation, the long-suffering Khadija Ismailova was subjected to an entirely new and systematic invasion of privacy, courtesy of Pegasus. And now, at the end of May 2021, more than a year and a half after NSO announced its industry-leading human rights policy, its all-star governance, risk, and compliance committee, and its robust vetting program, and as the company was preparing its first-ever transparency and responsibility report, Khadija Ismailova remained under constant cyber surveillance by the Azeri security services. When Claudio and Danica executed a jailbreak on Khadija's phones in the first week of June, they found evidence of more than 100 separate attacks over 18 months. All this thanks to the growing excellence of the relationship between President Ilham Aliyev and the leaders of the country that proudly declares itself the one and only bastion of democracy in the Middle East. The week before Khadija left Baku for her reunion with her OCCRP colleagues, President Ilham Aliyev appeared at a web conference sponsored by a foreign policy NGO in the Azeri capital. Aliyev was in fine fettle that day, still in the glow of the success of his military's lightning 44-day offensive against Armenia. He had already inaugurated a museum commemorating this victory, leading a state-run camera crew through the rows of captured Armenian military equipment and through an arch lined with helmets worn by killed and captured Armenian soldiers. Aliyev was happy to credit the key allies who helped the Azeri army retake land lost to Armenians 25 years earlier, in the earliest days of his father's presidency. He made a point to recognize the Israeli contribution during the Q&A portion of the web conference in Baku in late May 2021. Israel had provided billions of dollars of sophisticated military equipment over the previous 5 years, including the drones that had proved pivotal in Aliyev's recent triumph. "Our relations are very diverse," Aliyev said of his country's relationship with Israel. "We are active trading partners, and the volume of our trade is increasing. Azerbaijan has full access to Israeli defense industry products. It's not a secret. And now we are in the phase of new development in that area." Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had been nurturing this relationship with the Republic of Azerbaijan for years. He had made pilgrimage to Baku in 2016 to exercise his preferred brand of foreign relations. Commerce, in Netanyahu's view, was the necessary precursor to any international alliance. Israel was already a leading importer of Azeri goods by 2016, trailing only Italy and Turkey in raw volume. Israel was buying Azeri gold, tomatoes, and of course oil and gas, while promoting Caspian Sea vacation packages for tourists from Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and Haifa. Azerbaijan was importing Israeli agricultural technology and military hardware by the billions of dollars. 5 years later, wrote one Middle East expert and diplomat who worked at the European Parliament, this advanced weaponry proved instrumental to Azerbaijan's victory over Armenia. Israel's energetic efforts at trade and diplomacy in Azerbaijan were no different from its efforts all across the Middle East. At the end of May 2021, judging by the evidence the security lab and the reporters in our consortium had turned up from the leaked data, military-grade spyware was nested in the package of goodies Israel had to offer its prospective allies. Azerbaijan, Morocco, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia had all been operating NSO's Pegasus systems under licenses approved by the Israeli government. The former defense and intelligence officials we were talking to at the time were happy to explain the calculus. It all boiled down to the promotion of one thing, and that was Israeli security, which also boiled down to one thing: neutralizing the country that had been promising for generations to wipe Israel from the earth, Iran. All the trade with Azerbaijan, which included the licensing of Pegasus, was a security swamp. Aliyev gets the tools he needs to maintain control of his near-total domestic power and fence off his neighbors. And Israel, according to that Middle East expert from the European Parliament, gains a foothold on Iran's northern borders for intelligence gathering or even a launching pad for a potential military attack on Iran. The same calculus applied to Israel's attempts at improving relations with Morocco, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Netanyahu was working to create a united front against Iran in the Middle East, according to former Israeli government officials, and access to cutting-edge Israeli arms, including cyber weapons like Pegasus, was among the incentives the prime minister could offer. "Of course it helps," says Israeli national security expert Yoel Guzansky. Netanyahu's government lacked easy and open channels to spread those kinds of incentives in the capital cities of Rabat, Riyadh, and Abu Dhabi. No embassies, no consulates, no foreign service officers on the ground. Israel's chief point contact with these wary allies was its International Intelligence Service, the Mossad. Mossad is in charge of building diplomatic connections with the regimes where we don't have a diplomatic relationship, one former Israeli intelligence commander explained to us. When their intelligence counterparts in these countries started asking for Unit 8200 to level spyware technology to fight ISIS or homegrown terrorists, the Mossad had to demur. The Israeli military did not share its technology with anyone, not even close allies like the US and the UK. But Mossad could offer the next best thing, which was Pegasus. NSO's technology was top shelf, and NSO could be trusted to keep their collective mouths shut about who was buying and operating its spyware system. So tight-lipped were the officials at the top of NSO, in fact, that they even kept the identity of potential clients from the members of the company's new outside human rights advisors, who were supposed to provide guidance in vetting potential clients and in investigating claims of misuse. The updated compliance regime, which seemed more like an updated set of talking points, had been pushed hard by the new majority owner of NSO Group, the recently hatched London-based hedge fund Novalpina. More established firms had taken a hard look at buying NSO and bailed. The partners at Novalpina thought of themselves as buccaneers, willing to take chances on high-risk businesses others were afraid to touch. They told me it was a new fund that was supposed to be specializing in problem companies because usually they are underlisted and they make big money, says one potential investor. The three principals in the fund were thrilled to be able to help Shalev Julio and Omri Lavi buy out Francisco Partners in early 2019, and then they embarked on a campaign to refurbish the company image, which was in pretty poor shape after the revelations in Mexico and the allegations surrounding the Khashoggi case. For membership on the new compliance committee, the Novalpina moneymen wooed a number of respected European and American diplomats and intelligence specialists, promising them that they would have real impact on company policy. One of the potential human rights consultants, former French diplomat Gérard Arnault, was given a one-day tour of the NSO offices just before he signed on in September 2019. A modern tower in the northern suburbs of Tel Aviv, the chic district where they have a lot of embassies, RO remembers. They have the top three floors of a hyper-modern building. Everyone is in t-shirts and shorts. People are all between 28 and 35 years old. They arrive on scooters. The visit came with a brief rundown of Pegasus, but no demo of the system itself. I got some not very precise slides, he says. The presentation they gave me was for children, really. RO says he and his fellow human rights consultants had no real input into company business. A group of investors had once let slip to him that more than 40 client countries had been licensed to Pegasus. But nobody at NSO ever divulged to him the names of these countries, or even the names of prospective licensees. The NSO vetting process was an in-house operation, handled by the Governance, Compliance, and Risk Committee, and run with the exigencies of the Israeli Ministry of Defense in mind. The government mostly looks at it in the spectrum of what's good for Israel, says one cybersecurity expert we talked to in Israel. It's not about the ethics of the sales. They just want to make sure it won't be used against Israel. There was an acute sensitivity among Israeli authorities to the moods and responses of the governments of the United States and Russia. No U.S. phone number could be attacked by Pegasus, the Ministry of Defense and NSO claimed, nor could any phone be attacked by Pegasus while it was on U.S. territory. Somebody at the Ministry of Defense or at Prime Minister Netanyahu's office scotched Pegasus licensing deals to Ukraine and Estonia, according to reporting in March 2022 by Ronan Bergman and Mark Mazzetti of the New York Times, for fear of Vladimir Putin's reaction if it were found to have been used against officials in his Kremlin. North Korea, China, and Iran were deemed beyond the pale, but not many others. Not even Saudi Arabia. Not even in the aftermath of the Khashoggi killing. The Saudi rulers might be anti-democratic and serial violators of human rights, and even outright murderers. But they were becoming more aggressive in their efforts to help with what Israel most desired. Checking Iranian power. You can't always choose your allies, was Netanyahu's take. Interests trump friendship in the existential matters of national security. Holger Stark from our partner Die Zeit arrived in Tel Aviv on the same day Khadija Ismailova touched down in Ankara, May 29, 2021. 3 days later, and the day after Claudio confirmed that Khadija's iPhone had been targeted by Pegasus, Holger was busy confirming basic facts. NSO had clients in more than 40 countries. The company had about 860 employees and 550 of those, give or take, worked in research and development. More than half of NSO customers were government agencies in European countries. NSO officials estimated its value at about $1.5 billion, a bit less than what was being reported in the financial press. Noval Pina now owned 70% of NSO. Shalev and Omri maintained personal interest in the company worth about $10 million each. The Pegasus system represented about 65% of NSO's business, but the company hoped it would soon be less than half. Drone technology was the next big thing. Holger did find himself suddenly in the same room as Shalev Julio at one point in the trip. He used it as an opportunity to press the NSO CEO. "Okay, to make sure," Holger asked. "Pegasus was not used either before or after the Khashoggi murder to target the people around him?" Shalev answered, "No, not his wife, not family. Never, ever, 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 and never, and again. I am willing to do a polygraph on that. None of our technology actually had been used in that case."